You are listening to Kubernetes Bytes, a podcast bringing you the latest from the world of cloud-native data management. My name is Ryan Wallner, and I'm joined by Bhavin Shah, coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. We'll be sharing our thoughts on recent cloud-native news and talking to industry experts about their experiences and challenges managing the wealth of data in today's cloud-native ecosystem.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar-S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Good morning, good afternoon, and good evening, wherever you are. We're coming to you from Boston, Massachusetts. Today is August 22nd, 2022. Hope everyone is doing well and staying safe. Let's dive into it. Lots of twos in there. Good stuff. You know, before we dive into today's topic, it's a little bit of a special episode. I'll let Bhavin give you the gist in just a few minutes here, but let's just, you know, talk about what we've been up to, and then we can dive right into it.
Yeah, and the way you introduced the episode was perfect, even though it was not planned, right? A lot of twos. I think I've been thinking twos. I have. So this episode comes out on August 22nd. Tomorrow, I'm headed to Glacier National Park. And then in a week after that, I'm headed to Acadia National Park. So two national parks in 2 weeks on August 22nd, 2022. Let's do it.
and we have two guests. So, you know, all ringing a bell here. It's good. Great. What else do you have to do besides just those two national parks?
Oh, I'm just glad that the weather has cooled down. I postponed all my yard work. I think listeners will remember my first experience with it. The second was not better. Let me just say that. I was glad that at least I was doing it in a 70 degree weather, not a 90 degree weather. But we filled up, me and my neighbor filled up 730 gallon bags of yard waste. That's just 210 gallons. That's too much work.
Welcome to home ownership, Bhavin. Yes. Yeah. Every year, all the time, you get to do things like this now.
Mm-hmm. Yes, looking forward to it. How about you, Ryan? What have you been up to?
Cool. Yeah, I mean, mostly in enjoying the summer as much as I can. In a few days, I'm headed to, I don't know if there's any country fans here, but I'm going to Kenny Chesney at Gillette Stadium, which has been sort of a family tradition, but it's been canceled for 2-3 years now. And then this is his last year doing it. I like country. Don't get me wrong. I'm sort of a fan of all music. So, it's a good time. The whole family comes up, we go to the show and then we sort of have everybody over to, barbecue and hang out. And hopefully I the idea of it being warm still, cause people can just jump in the pool and have a good time. So looking forward to that. Obviously spending time with family is still always so important. So I'm excited for it.
Awesome. Today we have, as you said, two guests and two special guests. First, let me introduce Brendan Burns. Again, I don't think people need an introduction after listening to that name, but he's one of the co-founders of the Kubernetes open source project. And currently he's been up to, he's the corporate vice president of Azure Cloud Native Open Source. So the team that works and contributes to open source projects in the cloud native ecosystem. Brendan basically manages all of that. And as the second guest, we have somebody who's new to the ecosystem, Ganesh Kumar Ashoka Vardhanan. He's a software engineer who started in the AKS team last year. But if I remember correctly, I think he interned for a couple of summers and he's just starting his career journey at Microsoft by working on such cool products like AKS and all the different cloud native open source project that it has. I think in the episode, we do want to ask questions around what are the open source projects that Microsoft works with, but then also focus some time on AKS, how it helps customers, spend time, maybe ask around Windows containers if you get the time. But before giving up too much information, are you excited about this episode?
Yeah, I think, having someone definitely more senior and having someone new to the ecosystem and Microsoft in general, I'm really excited to get both, Brendan and Ganesh's perspective. So, I say without further ado, let's get them on the show. Welcome to Kubernetes Bytes, Brendan and Ganesh. I'm so excited to have you both here to talk all things Microsoft, Kubernetes, and you know a bunch of other things. Why don't we kick it off and just do a little bit of introductions and background of what you're both doing.
Hey, thank you so much for having us here. Really excited to be part of this podcast. I'm Ganesh Kumar, and I'm a software engineer in the Azure Kubernetes Service team, working primarily on the node lifecycle and Kubernetes versioning aspects. I graduated from UC Berkeley in 2021 with a degree in electrical engineering and computer science and a degree in business administration as part of the founding class of this program called the Management Entrepreneurship and Technology Program. Right after I graduated, I started full-time at Microsoft. And also during my time at Berkeley, I had the great opportunity to work at Microsoft during two internships.
Great. Well, glad to have you here.
Cool. Hi there. I'm Brendan Burns. I am the Corporate Vice President for Cloud Native Open Source and Management and Platforms at Microsoft Azure. I've been in the computer industry for close to 25 years, a lot of it dedicated to open source, but other things as well. Kind of been all over, did a PhD in robotics, was a professor for a while. And you know, as a result of being a professor, I love to see the interns come in and bring some of the fresh perspective into Microsoft. And I think Ganesh is a great example of how, you know, that program turns into great opportunities to make a difference for our customers.
Yeah, absolutely. And many might know Brendan as one of the founding members of Kubernetes. And since you mentioned robotics, I think, you know, Ganesh, we had a little bit of time to speak ahead of this podcast. And you mentioned a conversation you had early on when you were an intern with Brendan. Can you talk a little bit about that and how that really kind of, you know, piqued your interest?
Yeah, definitely. So I've been interested in robotics, machine learning, and also distributed systems for a while now. So during my first internship at Microsoft, I was working on Azure Compute Health Store team, which was essentially using infrastructure health signals to determine issues in Azure infrastructure based on anomaly detection algorithms. So in that internship, it was my first exposure to cloud computing, and I learned a ton about different aspects about cloud computing. And one of the ways in which I learned about Kubernetes was because my mentors then had shared about this paper called Borg Omega and Kubernetes. And then later on, I found out that that paper was co-authored by Brendan, and he was working at Microsoft. And I think he was in the same building where I was working in. So great. I thought that was really cool. And, you know, that's how I got interested in AKS and Kubernetes. And I switched into that team so I could learn more about Kubernetes. So in the AKS team, when I was interning in that summer, Brendan would actually organize these office hours with interns and have even many more one-on-one sessions with interns, which I always thought were sort of amazing because, you know, given his expertise and experience, you know, he still made time for interns and had these
nice
conversations. So in that process, when I was talking to him, I, you know, I was curious about how, you know, something that I noticed was that there was this link between robotics and Kubernetes concepts, especially around control loops and feedback loops. And it seemed like the concepts were similar. And I found out that Brendan did his PhD in robotics. And when I asked him if there were related connections, he actually did mention that many of those concepts were inspired by robotics. So I thought that was really cool. And in that we both had a similar interest and that, you know, it's also applicable in a sense to Kubernetes and distributed systems.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's such a really cool connection of, you know, the control loops and everything. I don't think most would think about that. I mean, maybe that's a personal opinion. I know very little about robotics, but it's a great connection since, you know, I've been in this Kubernetes world and I totally get it. So really, really cool stuff.
Okay, so I guess next question that I have is, Brendan, you said you lead the Cloud Native Open Source business unit at Microsoft. So I just wanted to learn more about how does Microsoft work with the open source ecosystem, especially like in the cloud native community, and then how it participates and owns these open source projects?
Yeah, for sure. I think that, you know, one of the things that I believe is really essential to building a product based on open source is that it's critical to be present in that community, right? You can't just sort of, you know, take it off GitHub, compile it, put it on your website and, you know, sort of walk away, right? You know, there's a lot of value for our end customers that we can deliver by being a part of the Kubernetes community. We'll talk about it a little bit later, but one of the things that, you know, Ganesh works on is versioning for Kubernetes and getting the latest versions of Kubernetes into the Azure Kubernetes Service. One of the reasons we can do that so quickly is because we have people who have been the release managers, right? So they've been intimately familiar with the release as it's proceeding, the roadmap is ahead. We can start working on snapshots ahead of time. We have people who work in the Kubernetes security projects so that, you know, we have visibility into evolving security issues and ensure that our customers are patched, you know, on that day zero when a CVE is released, right? So I think all of those things are just a critical part of delivering managed open source as a service. But also we want to innovate, right? And a lot of the innovation that we do is driven by our own customer needs. And, you know, the honest truth is that I think there's an expectation now in the cloud, especially in cloud native, that anything you do is portable. Right. We love it when people run on the Azure Kubernetes service, but they may also need to run Kubernetes on bare metal in a container ship, or they may be running across multiple clouds because they're a gaming company and they want to be, you know, as close to the customer as possible. And so they're going to not want to take a dependency on stuff that we're building unless they know they can work with that everywhere. Right. And so if you look like projects like Kata, which is the Kubernetes event-driven autoscaler, products like Dapper, which is around developer productivity, or even the work we've done to integrate Kubernetes and VS Code together, they're all focused on, delivering a lot of value for our Azure customers, but also delivering something that is useful in the broader Kubernetes ecosystem. And even in places, I think a great example of this is our work with the Flux community, which is a GitOps project in the CNCF. You know, we could have said, hey, you know what, we want to own it, right? We're going to create the Microsoft GitOps thing. But we looked out into the CNCF and, you know, there's already a really great community and a really great project there. And we said, actually, you know, we're going to go work with Flux, but we're not going to just take the code. We're going to actually become, you know, contributing members to that project. We're going to kind of talk philosophically about what does GitOps mean and how are we going to try and advance those ideas and thought leadership. So it's a bunch of different pieces that come together to really, I think, help move the broader cloud native community forward. And at the end of the day, just create a better experience for those customers running Kubernetes and cloud native workloads on Azure.
No, that really makes sense, right? It helps Microsoft and the overall community raise the lowest common denominator. So like you're not stuck at the very bottom. You are innovating and contributing back to those open source communities. So everybody can use those features, regardless of whether they are an Azure customer today or not. It just helps these open source projects be better.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, and the truth is the world is hybrid, right? I don't think there's anyone who believes that, you know, people are going to be able to run absolutely everything on a specific public cloud. I mean, maybe if you have some small applications, but, you know, there's going to be a mobile app or there's going to be a retail, you know, obviously if you have a retail store, physical brick and mortar store, it's not going to our data center, right? We have to build for this hybrid world, you know, and we're just seeing that breakdown where people aren't really writing code for the cloud. They're writing code for the entire world.
Yeah. And that brings up a good point, right? You know, breaking down these boundaries, making the services that we're working on more flexible so that, you know, people can go beyond the boundaries that we're sort of setting up for, you know, the basic use cases. You know, something you mentioned when we spoke a few weeks ago was the concept of developer productivity and sort of what it means, right? And I feel like this concept of, you know, being part of the open source, you know, projects, but being present and really caring about what else they're trying to do beyond, you know, just, you know, what AKS is up to, I think is a big thing. So maybe you could speak to a little bit about like what developer productivity means to you and, you know, how it all connects.
Yeah, I think actually Ganesh has a great perspective on some of the work he's been doing with EventGrid and otherwise for developer productivity in Kubernetes there.
Yeah. I think, so I had the great opportunity to work on this project to integrate EventGrid with AKS, which essentially improves developer productivity. So EventGrid is this Azure service that allows you to keep track of different events and create workflows based on that. And AKS users can use EventGrid to actually know about important events that happen in your cluster. One example is new Kubernetes versions being available in your cluster. Mm-hmm. And during my internship in AKS, I was lucky to be able to work on this project with my manager and another intern. And last year, it went into public preview as well. So with this feature, you can create workflows like being able to run test pipelines after a new version is available and mm-hmm. doing that automatically. And this integration is like one example of the developer productivity tools and integrations that Microsoft is developing. And there's also many other interesting projects that team members in AKS have worked on, such as Draft, which allows you to containerize your applications, even if they're not already containerized, and yep. it allows you to easily deploy them. So I think even the work in the open source community, it's really allowing users, not just in Microsoft, but everywhere else, to become more productive. And I think that is something that really aligns well with Microsoft's mission. And it's also something that I'm very interested in, because it allows one to scale your impact beyond, even beyond the product. And even at the product level itself, because of the global usage, you're really improving developer productivity for all the users of AKS yeah. or Azure. So,
yeah, I agree. I really like that, when a new version of AKS comes out, you get, you know, the event grid kind of action and be able to deploy some pipeline on it. I feel like that really targets, right, a real pain point that developers or even mm-hmm. Might have, and one that I've suffered from myself and in other communities deployments as well. So I think both between making it easier to get onboarded, right, like Draft, or being able to do these things that solve real pain points, I think that's, really obvious thing, but not everyone's thinking that way. So it's really cool to see those projects.
Yeah, I think we really are centered around that idea of empowering our users to do more. And oftentimes yeah. that means removing pain.
Yeah. Right.
It's not and I've always said I would rather build something that a million people use, than something that impresses some engineer down the hall.
Sure.
Right. Like, I could care less if someone thinks it's cool. I want a ton mm-hmm. of people to think it's useful. Right. I think sometimes we look at some of these cloud native projects and they're almost like designed for Twitter, yeah. like they have the cool logo and they, they're going to go do a meetup or whatever, but you dig in and you're actually like, why would I adopt this? Like, what is the pain you're removing? I think we get really blinded, right? And we forget that the truth is that 95% of the people who use Kubernetes, like, they're here to get a job done. Mm-hmm. They're not here because, they love the community, although it is a great community. Yeah. They're here to just get a job done. And our job as people who do love Kubernetes and are excited about it is to sort of get out of their way and help them be productive, right? And then also, I think the other thing that I've been thinking about, this is like the pointy-haired boss part of me where I've become more and more responsible for, larger organizations, is a realization that we also have to help people do the right thing,
yep.
right? Like we have to, when I think about software supply chain security, it's not okay to say you have to make sure that your images are secure. We have to develop infrastructure so that that person can't even deploy an insecure image, can't even check in a Docker file with an insecure image, right? Mm-hmm. Like it is unfair to a developer to expect that they're going to be able to keep track of the laundry list of, 20 million CVEs or whatever it is. and instead, this is automation. And I think in some sense, this is the next generation of DevOps. I mean, and they're calling it DevSecOps, which is, I cringe a little bit. Like, DevOps thing and I cringe a little bit. But I think that the motivation is right. Right. Yeah. The motivation yeah. of saying like, hey, security is not something that you remember or something that you memorize.
Yeah.
It's a core part of like your validation and deployment pipeline. It's a core part of CI/CD. It's even a core part of like your tools,
mm-hmm.
where we're going to put red squiggly lines under, your YAML file if uh-huh. something's wrong, right? I think that mentality shift is actually really valuable and is something that we're really going after.
And security shouldn't be an afterthought, right? As you said, like it has to be built in. And even if just the word DevSecOps instead of DevOps helps people like get into that mind frame of, oh, security is important. Maybe that's what its purpose is. Like, okay, people should be thinking about security.
Yeah. No, I think that's probably true, right? I mean, I think DevOps sort of said like, hey, you should be thinking about CI/CD and testing, right?
Yeah.
And the real that was like test and how do you deploy quickly with automation? And I think now saying like, okay, we test, but we also secure with automation. And it leads to good projects, right? Like a lot of our work on the Gatekeeper project for policy and Kubernetes, you know, is dedicated to exactly that. How do you make sure that people don't deploy stuff from, you know, random image pulls from Docker Hub or whatever it happens to be?
Yeah. And I feel like for years, right, with the complexity and sort of the newness of what Kubernetes was and the excitement around it, now we've finally gotten to a point where, you know, Kubernetes is becoming sort of this thing that's just there and that's fine. Now we're really focused on everything above that. Yeah. You know, that being said, we have to care a lot more about, you know, everything we put on it and that we're building these really great projects. And yeah, security has to be sort of inherent to the system to enable, right, to do this safely in production, especially with all, you know, the noise that is around security and ransomware and things that are going on. The first question that, you know, often comes up is like, you know, why is this system different? We're like, well, it's not, but you
No, so talking about security, and Brendan, you said there's a list of 20,000 CVEs. I know we had at least a couple of really popular ones with Log4j and like Spring for Shell. Ganesh, like since you are on the AKS team, how does that work? Like when a new CVE or day zero vulnerability comes online or gets published, how do we make sure the customers are patched and they can be up and running easily?
Yeah, I can share more about that and also want to sort of add on to what Brendan mentioned earlier. Mm-hmm. So, because AKS is a managed Kubernetes service, a lot of components are managed by AKS, and a lot of the security that customers would have otherwise had to take care of is also handled by AKS, which I think makes it easier for them to make sure that their workloads are secure. And there's so many other features that are built on top of AKS to make it easier for users to securely deploy their workloads and manage their infrastructure securely. So I think that is sort of one major way in which AKS sort of simplifies security for many users. Mm-hmm. And particularly if we have some vulnerabilities in components that AKS itself manages, I think there's different avenues depending on the type of issue as well. Sometimes we have embargoed CVEs that we would handle. Mm-hmm. We'd make sure it's deployed before, you know, even it's announced. The exact details I mentioned earlier. And then there's this huge group of people within Microsoft as well who actively look at security issues and provide information to make AKS more secure. And some parts of this process, I think, still need to be automated, just like Brendan mentioned, in terms of hotfixing previous releases or simplifying the process of applying these changes before, and also making it easier for users of AKS to actually consume these security patches easily and automatically. I think there's a lot of work going on there. And, you know, part of what I do as well has been in terms of applying these fixes for, you know, currently used AKS infrastructure. So I think the process is involved depending on the use case, and it's, but it also makes it easier for users because we handle it. All the
heavy lifting is done by those engineering teams or development teams in the background. So for the customer, it's maybe a right click upgrade, and you don't have to worry about the CVE again. I think that's what I'm getting from your answer.
For sure. And I think what's interesting even there has been, we've seen an evolution, right? Like we actually offer auto upgrade at this point, right? Where you can tick a box and we'll automatically upgrade you the minute it happens, you know, the minute it comes out. And to be honest, like in a couple of cases with severe CVEs, we've just done that anyway. It was bad enough that we figured, hey, any risk of instability is outweighed by the security risk. But I think what's really interesting there is like there's this evolution in our customer set, which is 3 years ago, nobody would turn on auto update. Right? They were just terrified, right? Like they want to be sitting at the keyboard watching the thing as it goes through. And I think in part because, you know, we've done a lot to improve auto upgrade and reduce the impact, but also because people have become better at building cloud native applications, right? They've become better at building applications where if, you know, you one by one remove and upgrade machines, like their application just handles it.
Yep.
They're getting more comfortable with this notion of auto upgrade, And the analogy I kind of give is like, it used to be, you know, you paid a ton of attention to like what version of your web browser you were running. Mm-hmm. Like, you know, Internet Explorer 6.5 or whatever it is, right? Now, like, nobody could tell you what version of a web browser they're running. Right? Yep. Like, they don't even know how to figure it out. And I think we're going through that same kind of iteration with cloud native, where upgrade and response to CVE just becomes something that happens transparently in the background rather than, you know, something where you're thinking a lot about it. And it requires a bunch of different coordination from all sorts of different people.
I almost want to say that, you know, the notion of things happening automatically and auto updating is sort of built into the definition of what is cloud native to begin with, right? Anyway, if you were kind of ask me like what makes something cloud native, I think the conversation of something just automatically being able to update and take care of things like that would be part of that conversation. So I think there's also a paradigm shift, right, of maybe new developers also becoming used to the expectation that this is going to be happening. So therefore, they're more comfortable with the, you know, this, you know, type of feature and turning it on, and maybe not having the PTSD from like back in the day and like managing OpenStack clusters or something.
Yeah. No, I think we have seen a whole spectrum. Like, we spoke to somebody from MongoDB, and the developer, like when he entered the ecosystem, operators are already a thing. So he didn't know a world before operators existed. So that's like a one side. And then the other side is those Microsoft SQL Server admins or Windows admins that have to worry about patch Tuesdays and making sure all of their servers are updated. So I think that's like, you are on this journey, and then hopefully as we like go on this and like maybe in the next 5 years, auto upgrade becomes the baseline configuration that you need for your clusters.
Yeah, I think that's absolutely, you know, where we're headed. And it requires, it's a careful dance, right? Like, if Kubernetes doesn't have health checks, or honestly, like if the developer doesn't know to define a health check, because it's kind of scary to have it don't, you know, we're really limited in our ability to safely upgrade something.
Yeah.
And so like, is this dance between like the developers getting more aware, like if I tick these boxes, then this automation can help me. But also getting comfortable with the fact that, oh yeah, it's been a few years since an upgrade killed me. It's going to be okay. Although it'll still happen eventually. I guarantee you.
Feed all over Twitter. Okay. So I think, Brendan, you were talking about the next step, right? Like where the community is headed. And like my question was, like, since you are involved in the origin of Kubernetes as a project, where, like, how do you see people using something like AKS versus something like Azure Container Apps or serverless with like Azure Functions? How do those things work together, and how can developers choose which one to like use?
Yeah, man, I spend so much of my life on this particular topic right now. I don't know. And I think that the TLDR of it is that, you know, what has happened in the past is that platform choice of whether it's Azure Container Apps or Cloud Foundry or Heroku or, you know, Lambda or whatever your favorite, you know, platform is, was a really, really heavyweight choice. It was a choice of where your code ran, as well as like how you wrote the code. How easy or hard is it to write the code?
Yeah.
And I think what we're trying to drive towards in Azure and with AKS is a world where those two choices are separated, right? Where your code, well, it runs in AKS no matter what. Mm-hmm. And if you run an Azure container app, ultimately that container is running in a Kubernetes cluster, right? Yeah. So no matter what, your code is running in a Kubernetes environment. But the way of writing that code and the sort of the infrastructure around running that code might be a functions as a service, or it might be a Helm chart. And those two things can interoperate, right? Mm-hmm. So that function as a service can really easily call that MongoDB that's being run by the operator, right? And that's not where we are right now, right? Like if you write an Azure function and you want it to call into a MongoDB that's running in an AKS cluster, that's a hard thing to do.
Yep.
And that's why it feels like such a heavyweight choice to people. But I think what I really think we're driving towards is a world where actually, you know, Kubernetes kind of becomes the underlying operating system.
Sure.
And whether you are, you know, writing C code down in the guts of the operating system, or you're writing Visual Basic code out, you know, at the high level, or even no code, right? Low code, no code stuff. Excel, maybe. shout out, by the way, to the Excel Esports Championship. Oh, yeah. Just, oh, it's so cool. You know, but no matter which of those you're going through, you know, the inter-process communication is the same and the file system is the same. You know, metaphorically, file system is the same. I think that's where we need to get, because otherwise we're just going to continually be in this world where people are debating, like, how do I balance developer productivity of a platform like Functions with freedom and flexibility and an ecosystem of operators and everything else that are going to be based on these lower level concepts. And, you know, I don't think it's a winning solution to say, well, it's great for you to use this Functions as a service, but you can't run MongoDB yourself, right? That's never going to win.
Interesting. Like, that's just a lot to think about. Like, just to, I don't know, have that information sit in the, I'll need to listen to this again, but go ahead, Ryan.
Yeah. Well, so one thing I did learn in a little bit of research is that, you know, container apps is built on AKS, right? And so there's a bit of a notion of, like, this thing is sort of, you know, inherited it to a certain aspect, where if you do start with something like container apps, because it's focused on, like, being the right tool for maybe that use case, you could have sort of a path off in and with more flexibility with something like AKS. Is that, like, part of the journey as well?
Yeah, that's absolutely part of the journey, is that, you know, that container image and things like Dapper, you know, can absolutely are portable into the AKS environment. I think, you know, we really want it to be seamless, right? It's where it's not a redeploy. Like, right now, it would be a redeploy. Take your application out of this environment, put it into the AKS environment. Yeah. I think ideally, it's actually more of, like, just kind of a who's responsible, who manages it. Does Azure manage it for you, or are you responsible for managing it for you? And that's a choice that you could make effectively on a running thing. And, you know, it's going to take a long time for us to get there, I think, but that's the North Star.
Right? Gotcha.
Got it.
Yeah. And, I was just going to ask Ganesh a question around, like, developer productivity and VS Code and the work that Microsoft has done, right? I know we spoke some about Kubernetes versioning in AKS and how that is managed, but how do I get my code, maybe that's, I'm working on it on my laptop, into an AKS cluster, and how does that workflow work? I know you already hinted at something like Draft, but can you expand a bit more on that, please?
Yeah, sure. And I can also touch a little bit about other ways in which I think AKS improves productivity for users compared to, you know, managing your own Kubernetes clusters. Oh, so the upgrade process, for instance, just like we mentioned, has been elaborate in the past. And even for Kubernetes versions, particularly minor versions, you know, it can be elaborate if you're doing it completely on your own. And one of the things that I learned after I joined full-time was Kubernetes versioning itself is quite an elaborate process, in that there's a lot of APIs that can get deprecated, feature flags that are deprecated, and as a managed service, we also have to handle a lot of edge cases with respect to how users, you know, use these different features. So one of the things that I worked on quite extensively was also Kubernetes versioning, and I think because we handle as AKS handle. You know, all these edge cases and making sure you're able to upgrade without breaking, you know, your APIs and so on. That I think really improves developer productivity for all users of AKS. And that is something that I've found to be quite satisfying as well, especially when seeing people tweet about it or, you know, lots of AKS users, you know, using these versions that I've helped drive with the team. And going, I guess, back to the other part that you asked about, you know, in terms of broader developer productivity, the Event Grid integration is for when you already have your AKS cluster set up. And then prior to that, there's recent developments that the other members of the AKS team have worked on, like Draft, which just makes it easy for you to containerize your applications, even if it's not containerized. So you just, you know, install the tool and, you know, you need to provide some information like the ports that are used and so on. And then it will actually generate the Helm charts and manifests for you. And it makes it easier to deploy onto Kubernetes. And also touching on what Brendan said, you know, I think there's a lot of different ways in which you can actually eventually end up deploying your applications on Kubernetes, but hide away many of the abstractions from users. So, yeah.
So are you saying I don't need to learn how to write my own YAML files if I install Draft?
Pretty much. Sorry. No, that's the goal. Let's say on-demand learning.
Yeah, sure.
Right? Which is to say, learning YAML will not get in the way of deploying your first application to Kubernetes. We expect right. that sooner or later, you're going to need to sling some YAML. Mm-hmm. You know? But it's not going to get in the way of that first like kind of dopamine hit of like yeah. that app is now running in this cloud mm-hmm. environment. And I think even beyond that, like when we think about the VS Code work that we've done, mm-hmm. It's little things, right? Like mostly people don't know that there's this feature called kubectl describe. Mm-hmm. Right? If you say kubectl describe and some path into an API object, it'll give you a little blurb about, you know, what that field does in that YAML mm-hmm. file. But the truth is the ergonomics of that are terrible, right? Like who wants to go into the command line and type kubectl describe field name, blah, blah, blah. So with the extension, we've integrated that with the YAML file with a hover card, right? Mm-hmm. So that you can turn it on. And if you hover over a field in a pod definition or in a deployment definition, it'll give you the little description of what that field does, right? You know, something like replicas, it's really obvious what it does, but something, you know, like
Ingress.
Yeah, there's all sorts of different stuff, or like the deployment, like all the different options for how you configure a deployment, like when a deployment proceeds, like period, seconds, whatever. So being able to basically, in the midst of your YAML editing, hover over the field and have it describe for you, you know, what that field does, just improves somebody's productivity, reduces what they have to learn beforehand, and enables mm-hmm. them to effectively like on demand learn it.
Context switching, I feel like, you know, not having to say like, oh, what is this thing? Hold on, let me go like find the API or Google it or find the whole path and use this other CLI tool. Just not having a context switch, right?
For sure. Small, yeah. Yeah. I mean, and also similarly, you know, putting in a little red squiggly line that says, hey, this isn't going to deploy right because your YAML mm-hmm. indentation isn't quite right, or, you know, whatever. There's all of these things that you can do in that familiar editing environment. Yeah. You know, another thing, you know, people do kubectl apply all the time. I mean, we would suggest maybe that GitOps and CI/CD is a better way to manage your cluster. But the truth is people do kubectl apply. If you do that in the context of VS Code, we're going to show you a visual diff.
Mm. Oh,
right. So you're going to be able to actually see like, oh, great. You know, replicas is going from 3 to 15. And you'll also see, oh, image is going from V10 to V1. Maybe I didn't actually mean for that to happen, right?
Yeah.
And so you just that visualization, it just helps, right? Like it just, I think there's a lot to be said for the command line, but there's a lot to be said for places where the sort of information density of a GUI can help you more.
And it's all of these smaller things, right? Like in a delivery system, we know the last mile is the hardest, so like having all of this integrated into the IC that you're using, that just makes it easier.
Yeah, I mean, and I think that, you know, actually just came from the meeting, but like be sitting in live site meeting every week, right? Sitting in the meeting where we go over outages and how they mm-hmm. happened. And like, you just really learn a lot about how this stuff just happens because, I mean, sometimes there's really bad, weird bugs, but a lot of it is just because somebody, you know, was distracted or it just wasn't easy enough. Like they had to, as you said, like they have 4 different tabs open. They're switching between different tabs. They forgot what they cut and pasted. They just didn't see the, you know, they had an old Git mm-hmm. repo. They hadn't refreshed that Git repo. Like, and the more we can do, I don't look at that and think that, boy, that developer messed up. I look at that and I think, oh my God, we failed these people. Mm. Right. Like this is what tooling is supposed to prevent you from. It's like we're handing out razor blades, basically.
It shouldn't be a resume generating event for the developer. It should be a feature generating event for the product manager, I guess.
100%, right? It's 100% true.
Yeah, there begs the question of you know, can we make it easier for people to get to the spot where kubectl apply isn't sort of like they've gotten to a point and they're like yes and just throw it over the wall because they have that tool at their hand, but it's much easier to get a pipeline or a GitOps pipeline sort of set up for them you know, from the get-go, so that way they're thinking that way from the get-go.
Yeah, and I think fully featured too, right? Like, I think one of the things I've seen in a lot of the, like, here's how you set up your CI/CD is that it doesn't leave empty spots for all the things that you will eventually need. Like, it gives you a really basic CI/CD, but there's no slot that says, like, you should probably put testing here, right? Or a slot that says, hey, you should probably put some sort of, like, stage map multi-region thing here, right? And I think that's part of it as well, is that you know, we don't have that mindset of like, well, what does day N look like when we're trying to get people started on day zero?
Absolutely. I'm going to switch gears a little bit here because it's been a burning question I know I've had and Bhavan and I have had because it's something that, you know, in our day jobs and things like that, we've paid attention to is sort of the state of Windows containers, right? You know, obviously what that looks like in AKS, what's the adoption of you know, what people are doing with Windows containers. I'm just curious about it all, I guess.
Yeah, for sure. I mean, so we continue to see strong interest in Windows containers. And of course, I've got some members of my open source team that are dedicated working in upstream on Kubernetes support for Windows containers and increasing parity, right? There's definitely some places where, you know, there's just not parity between the Kubernetes support in for Windows and for Linux. Sure. You know, I was just talking to somebody about legacy computing because, you know, it's just something that's fascinating to me. And someone was discovering a sort of underworld of legacy computing. And I think the truth is that there's a ton of binaries and a ton of executables out there that, you know, that source code is long gone, right? And nobody's gonna, like, nobody's going back for it. Nobody's coming back for that code, right? And so I think when we think of, when we look at Windows containers, a lot of what we see is it's an opportunity to move like that last 10%.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you're going to modern development. I think the new development, even in .NET is happening with .NET on Linux, and .NET Core on Linux. But, you know, there's a bunch of like mission critical C++ code that was written a bunch of time ago. It's just not moving. And the ability then, but then the ability to get that into the cluster to really like get every, you know, update your development processes, your CI/CD, all of that stuff is just a huge advantage for people, right? Not have it be a weird singleton, but have it like look and smell and feel like the same to the monitoring systems and to the logging systems and all of that kind of stuff. There's a ton of win for people in that. You know, and we've seen some great examples of Windows container usage. You know, in fact, actually Forza 5 up on AKS is using Windows containers for the backend for Forza.
Nice.
That's pretty cool. So yeah, it's definitely, and I mean, obviously that's not even that legacy, right? Like that's
new-ish development. Gaming is never legacy,
But, well, gaming has a ton of legacy, actually. It's amazing. Like when you go talk to gaming companies and you think of it as being like super modern and stuff and you're like, whoa. And also they have like a lot of, you know, a lot of the code they wrote started on, like, client server is a relatively new thing in the game industry.
Sure.
You know?
Wow. Okay.
Well, I mean, I'm just saying, like multiplayer continues to evolve, right? Like, like a lot of the, a lot of the infra that they built was single player on Windows or on Xbox or on console for a really long time. Right. And they're, you know, continuing to evolve and to address distributed systems, but like it's, there's definitely legacy there.
Okay, got it. So I think we are running up to our time limit. I think I do want to end with this question. Like Ganesh, why don't we start with you, right? We have discussed so many things about how cloud native open source works at Microsoft, how the team is empowered to go and contribute to these projects and be release leads. If people want to get started with not just Microsoft and their journey at Microsoft, but even open source projects, what do you recommend as somebody who has entered the ecosystem in the over the past year?
Yeah, I think I want to also just mention that really the impact that we have at Microsoft and through working in AKS is just tremendous. And I think the scale of impact through projects like Event Grid integration with AKS or Kubernetes versioning and so on is quite awesome to see. And a lot of the ways in which I sort of learned about this was through engineers in the team, but also through a lot of open source sort of tutorials and videos and so on. And actually, Brendan himself has, you know, contributed to a lot of that, so which is pretty cool. So even when I was getting started in Kubernetes, I was watching videos that Brendan had on, you know, how Kubernetes works and so on. And then even his Kubernetes up and running book as well has been a reference for me. So a lot of these resources are helpful. And I think particularly for people who are starting and they're outside of Microsoft, maybe working on projects hands-on, trying to deploy any applications that they've written onto Kubernetes or using a managed Kubernetes service like AKS early on, I think is helpful in understanding like how the entire flow is. And that's not something that you often tend to do in university. So I think it's a great way to get started. And I also want to plug that, you know, at Microsoft, you do have an incredible opportunity to work and connect with senior engineering talent like Brendan, who are really willing to mentor young engineers.
Same question to you, Brendan. Like, how can people get started?
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the things that's valuable, there are maybe two things to think about. You know, one is that it's easier than you think, right? And I think sometimes people look at it and they get kind of intimidated. But like the truth is that like every open source maintainer and every open source project I've ever run across has fewer people than they would wish for working on them.
Yeah.
Right? Everybody is strapped for people to come and help. Like, they don't want people to come and do drive-bys, right? So realize that when you're doing it, it needs to be a commitment. You need to be willing to put aside, you know, say, hey, I'm going to actually focus on this thing a little bit for 3 months, 6 months, or whatever. And I'm not going to just kind of try and do one PR and vanish, right? It needs to be a little bit of a commitment. But every project has too few people working on it, right? And so there's definitely opportunity out there. But on the other hand, I will also say it's probably going to be harder than you think. Because like you're going to do all this hard work and you're going to craft up this PR and you're going to be so excited and happy about this PR and you're going to submit it and it's going to get torn to shreds or somebody's going to tell you that like, well, no, we thought about that 3 years ago and we decided not to or whatever. And I think it's also important to realize that that's going to be part of the learning experience.
Yeah.
It doesn't mean anything about you. Right. Like it's about learning how to be in these communities and about what the community expectations are. And I will tell you that like, every time I push a PR into a new repo that I have never been in before, I still have that experience. Right? I'm a little bit better about it because I know kind of the red flags that are true of all projects. Yeah. And I know a little bit about how you read up and look at other PRs and kind of try and get a sense for the culture. But like every first PR I've ever done, you know, takes a month or longer to get merged. Yeah. Just because you got to have to kind of like get in with like their processes, right? And also like they, to be honest, like, random PRs from new people, they get ignored for a time. Yep. You have to be patient.
Patience is a virtue. And soon enough, before you know it, you will be tearing PRs apart yourself, I'm sure.
You haven't fixed my bug yet, guy. I mean, like, what? You have a day job or something?
That's funny. No, like, again, the thing with open source communities, especially the different SIGs that the Kubernetes community has, that they are open, right? Like, all the meeting notes are in a Google Doc. All the meetings are recorded in Zoom and available for you to watch. So if you ever need to like find out where to find answers for certain things, there's a way why certain features are built, there's always a recording where those things were discussed. So like, don't be afraid, just go and go in the archives and like find that information yourself.
And I could also share a little bit of an anecdote to what sort of Brendan was saying, because recently I've been involved in this project for container acceleration on AKS, which is essentially speeding up image pulls and pod start times. And also tying into what we were saying earlier about really thinking about open source throughout AKS, we've been considering various open source solutions and trying out different tools. And I've been able to try out new projects that are oftentimes in the nascent stages in terms of identifying what could be useful for us. So in this process, I've been able to go through the same cycle that Brendan is saying in terms of learning how the repo works, getting it set up, which itself can be a complex process. But I think one interesting observation is that a lot of these projects, which are part of CNCF, they have, you know, very helpful developers, you know, not just in Microsoft, but in mm-hmm. other companies as well, who are very responsive in Slack and in terms of helping you understand how, you know, to get set up and how to contribute and so on. So I would, you know, encourage someone who wants to start to actually, you know, try things hands-on and also ask questions and not really hesitate too much in terms of making progress.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, the community is one of the greatest parts, I think, about, you know, Kubernetes and the different companies involved in it. Half the time, you don't even know which companies they're a part of because they're there to answer your questions and help you first. And speaking of community, you know, we're going to wrap the show up. You know, thank you both for coming on and being part of our little podcast here. It's been really insightful, and we really appreciate you both taking the time and joining the show.
Absolutely. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thank you so much.
Well, Bhavan, I think, you know, that was one of my favorite conversations of season two here so far. And, you know, I have a lot more questions I feel like I have for both of them. But as far as takeaways, you know, what did you really get out of that conversation?
Yeah, that's a takeaways perspective. I think if we start at the very beginning of our questions, right? Developer productivity and the Microsoft's goal of making sure that developers have an easy experience writing those apps, pushing it to writing in containers and then pushing it to AKS, or even if it's not AKS, something that's in the ecosystem, maybe a different managed service, maybe Kubernetes on bare metal, that really helps. Small things that we discussed in the episode, like having those hover descriptions of different Kubernetes objects, giving you those red squiggly lines if you have errors in your YAML file definition. All of that really helps. These are the small things that will make any developer's experience with Kubernetes and with containers really easy. So that was a big takeaway for me.
Yeah, you know, I agree completely. Those little additions to things like VS Code and kubectl mm-hmm. explain and the hover, right? Those are integral, I think, to, you know, making a developer happy in general and making their life a little easier. You know, to me, I really liked sort of Brendan's take on being present in the community, right? Whether mm-hmm. you're at and representing a big company like Microsoft and part of a project like AKS, making sure open source in the community comes first and doing that by being present, right, is, you know, a big part of sort of what, you know, you should be doing. And the fact that when you're part of open source, you know, the thing he said towards the end of, you know, all these projects need more help. Yeah. And to, you know, don't be scared to get involved and get your feet wet, but also don't think it's going to be a walk in the park, right? To make sure you want to sort of invest some time into getting to be part of these projects and to learn the process of submitting code and being part of a PR review and what that's like and kind of working your way through the project, I think is really valuable information to someone looking to get involved in these projects. I know in the past, with my experience in OpenStack, right, mm-hmm. it was similar in the sense that it was very open source focused and projects were, you know, begging people to come join and be a part of it. But where do you start, right? A lot of it a lot of it back then was, you know, go and squash some bugs to get your feet wet, because squashing bugs is low hanging fruit and you can fix something and get generally a smaller, you know, PR cycle mm-hmm. because it's probably, you know, a lot less code than a whole new feature. But, you know, if you want to tackle new features and be part of something new, it, you know, it's going to take longer. But, you know, just getting the sort of experience, and to your point around, you know, the SIGs and being open, just start being a part of it. I think those were really the things I really like to take out of that conversation.
I think the comment that Brendan made, right, that if you are participating in a project, it can't be a one-off thing. Like, you have to make that commitment. It can't be a drive-through, right? You have to actually go inside and make some sausage. Like, even though that's a tedious part of the job, you have to do it. So I think that's really important. And then just having these different perspectives, as you said in the intro, right? Ganesh, who's new to the ecosystem, and Brendan, who basically like was one of the co-founders of this ecosystem, that really helped. And then talking to them about where they see this community heading towards, talking about how functions and containers and Kubernetes works together, How does things like auto upgrade work to handle those CVEs? Those were some really, I'm just glad that people who are offering these services and participating in the community are actually putting some thought behind it. And it's not just whatever will make the biggest noise on Twitter is the feature that's getting prioritized. It's actually trying to solve customer challenges. And having that as the number one priority is perfect. So I guess I'll just end it there.
Yeah, absolutely. Like Brendan said, he'd rather help a ton of people than just mm-hmm. have one person think it's cool. I think that's a thoughtful insight. Yes. Well, with that, you know, as always for our listeners, please go ahead and share our episodes, give us feedback, whether that's on Anchor, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, whatever you use to listen to podcasts, please give us a shout, a DM, a message, wherever you can. And, you know, with that, this brings us to the end of today's episode. I'm Ryan.
I'm Bhavin.
And thanks for joining another episode of Kubernetes Bytes. Thank you for listening to the Kubernetes Bytes podcast.